I just learned about a very interesting quote by a man named Edward Allan. The quote is, "What the public thinks the blind are, that they will become." Someone later added to that, "What workers for the blind think the blind are, that they will make them become." When a sighted person sees a blind person, their first reaction is sometimes pity. When blind people certainly don't need anyone's pity. Many blind people have interesting work, interesting lives, family, friends. I've asked three blind people to join us today to talk to us about their lives, about how they do their work, and how they go about day-to-day living, and about when they would like someone's help, how they indicate it, and when they don't need anyone's help. Joining me is Bruce Mills, a jazz pianist who lives in New Jersey, who has joined us in the past on Fresh Air to talk about his music. Also with me is Sandy Smith, an equal opportunity specialist who works with the HEW branch in Philadelphia. Also joining us is Peter Putnam, who's the president of Recording for the Blind and an author. His most recent book is called Love in the Lead, and it's a history of the seeing eye dog. I'd like to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Nice to be here.
I thought I'd start by asking you about the work that you do, since each of you have really interesting work. Sandy, I'd like to ask you, of the three people in the room, you are the one that has a real 9-to-5 type job. Was it hard for you to find this job? Has it been hard for you to find jobs being blind?
I think so, and if any blind person told me it wasn't hard, I wouldn't believe them. I think that the general public's reaction is, you can't do this job. Why are you coming to be interviewed at my agency for this job? I think what happens is that I would go in for job interviews, and I think people forgot that I became qualified to work, went to college, went to graduate school, and became trained as a blind person. I didn't just drop out of a vacuum yesterday, be blind, not have any training, and go ask for a job. And I think people, they don't stop to think and say, well, she must know what she's doing or she probably wouldn't be here. I think that's really the crux of why it's hard.
Peter Putnam, you've been a professor, or a teacher at Rutgers. I'm not
Princeton.
Quite sure. Princeton, that
Please,
is right.
That,
yes, okay. What kind of difficulties or lack of difficulties did you have in getting the teaching job there?
Well, it was fairly difficult. As a matter of fact, when I went back to Princeton, I went blind my junior year and came back to Princeton. I had some difficulty getting back in. I had gone to the seeing eye in the meantime, and the committee that I went to see suddenly changed their mind and thought I should go to a blind school for the blind for a couple of years to learn the various techniques of blindness. Well, I could already type by touch, which they knew because I'd written them letters. I had a seeing eye dog with me. None of the books that I needed would have been in Braille anyway. I could take notes with Braille. And I think they were just simply exaggerating the idea of what blindness is. And later I found when I went on to graduate school that they hadn't expected me to do that. And friends who've seen transcripts of the thing saying Putnam is attempting the absolutely impossible, etc., which was not impossible. And I had a hard time getting a job afterwards. I got my PhD in 1950 from Princeton. And if you recall, colleges were very overcrowded at that time and undermanned because there hadn't been anybody able to take doctorates. Doctorates were not as cheap as they are today. But I could not get an interview with anyone. And finally pulled rank with a friend who had some, was a wealthy alumnus of a college which shall be nameless. He wrote to the guy, and he wrote the following answer: "Dear blank, Peter Putnam sounds like a very worthy young man who will need all the help he can get. Yours cordially." That was his response. I did get a teaching job at Princeton, and I taught there for 5 years. I enjoyed it very much, but ultimately, instead of getting tenure, I got promoted to a rank called lecturer, which means you can move sideways forever. And because at that time my publishers were more enthusiastic about my writing than the teaching profession was about my teaching, I quit and just became a writer.
Bruce, you're a jazz musician, and I'm interested in hearing about some of the difficulties or lack of difficulties you've had being on the road, getting jobs with jazz musicians who are in town, people like Mel Jackson, who I know you've played with here in the Philadelphia area. Has being blind been a serious handicap for your music and for your playing?
Well, I don't think so for
for either for the music or for playing or for getting jobs. Of course, when I got the job with Milt, I was called, you know, by other musicians that that knew me, and that's how I got onto that job. I think that the only way that blind would affect this kind of a thing, as far as the job is concerned, is that most people that work in any kind of clubs or that do anything, work in offices or anywhere, have cars. And I don't know, I don't think they've invented a Braille car yet, but anyhow, I don't have one. So that means that somebody's got to take me home. So sometimes that gets a little bit difficult, and I guess it may be that there are times when I haven't been able to get a certain job because they knew that they would have to take me home. That could be either 5 miles or 35. The distance doesn't make any difference. It's just one of those things, you know.
But it was not on account of your blindness. I mean, there's no prejudice against you that way.
No.
Jazz musicians have been very open on that, haven't they?
Yeah, I should think they've been. Jazz musicians are like a family, you know. They generally, they look out for one another, you know.
Do any of you feel like you have to prove yourself more than a sighted person would have to, that you would have to be doubly good in your position in order to maintain it?
I would rather not. You know, sometimes I've heard of people that have to write letters to certain people saying, just because I'm blind, that doesn't mean that I'm a this and that and all that kind of other stuff. I hope I never have to be in that position to do that, you know. But
Sandy, what about you?
I don't know if it's that you have to be doubly good or if it's that you're not permitted to fail. I think that's probably a better emphasis. But people watch a lot of films about handicapped people, and all they ever talk about are the ones who succeeded. And that's fine. I'm glad to hear people have succeeded, but they never talk about the ones who didn't and say, well, this one didn't succeed because his office was really insensitive to his problems. But on the other hand, this one didn't succeed because he was an incompetent worker.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
You know, so I think that people don't allow us that opportunity to fail. I have the fortune right now. I've been in a job where I'm very happy. My coworkers have been tremendous to me. If I make a mistake, they laugh it off like anyone else's. But when I first started there, people were apprehensive enough about my being there that
they
were
watching you. Right.
Right. I don't think they do that anymore.
Uh-huh.
But I think that at first that is the case.
Yeah.
Peter, how would you react to that?
Well, I think there's there tends to be in the public a view that anything that we do is superhuman, and then if we are bad, then that's magnified too, just because we're somewhat
unusual.
We'll have a high profile. There was a book written called "The Unseen Minority" by what's her name, Kessler, Frances Kessler, for the American Foundation for the Blind. I don't think it's true. I think we're quite visible. And not as visible as some other handicapped people, I'm sure. But still, I think they glamorize what you do, what's successful. Isn't that marvelous? Bruce Mills can play the piano.
Hmm.
And they give us double lumps for what.
Well, I remember when I was in about fifth grade, we had auditorium, or assembly, I guess it was called, every Wednesday and Friday at 11, I think it was. And once they brought in one of the boys from the school who was blind and said, well, now, boys and girls, we're in for a real treat. You know, blah, blah is going to play piano for us now. And isn't it amazing? He's blind and he can play. And we were supposed to be really in incredible awe of the fact that a blind person was able to do something like that. Is that offensive?
Could I make a point here about that?
I
would really wish people would get away from this mentality of saying that we're amazing. And people say, isn't it amazing you can read Braille? Well, no. If the amount of training that was put in on me had been put in on me and I couldn't read Braille, that would be more amazing. You know, if I couldn't use a dog or a white cane after the training I had, that would be more amazing than the fact that I can. You know, I had to learn to do these things. There's really a method to our madness. And if people would just stop and say that, well, somewhere you had to learn, it would take us off that pedestal and put us down with the rest of the world. I think this amazing mentality is just a way of putting us at a distance.
What are some of the trainings that each of you have undergone? Peter, I know you have the guide dog, seeing eye dog.
Right.
Are there other trainings? Did you train to work with a cane?
No, I never. But seeing eye is the only training I've ever had, except, well, I had some home teacher lessons in Braille, and I think I probably had about 3 hours of teaching in Braille altogether, and the rest of it you teach yourself. Or I did.
How did you learn Braille, Bruce?
Well, about the same time that most 4- and 5-year-old kids read print, I guess. You know, I learned when I was very young, with the help of a certain New Jersey agency, you know, because I went to public school, you see, up until 7th grade, you know, which I consider myself very lucky that I went to public school.
You know, that was a wonderful thing in New Jersey, which we are both citizens of, and it's many respects a very backward state, but the Beadlestone bills enabled the handicapped to go into the public school system a long time before a lot of other places were doing it.
That's right, yeah.
And
that's called the New Jersey Plan. The program for blind people all over the country was often referred to as the New Jersey Plan.
Did you go to a public school, Sandy?
Yeah, I went through a public school system in Wilmington, Delaware. I had parents who may even be listening today who were of a tremendous amount of support to me. I don't care what kind of training one has as a handicapped child, assuming one has a handicap from the time one is a child. You've got to have a family that's going to back you up. It's just essential. And I did. I had parents that let me do just about anything I could do and learn to do.
Can I throw in another comment there? Because your parents backed you and got you into the public school system, but something I think that is so important is you need peer group, sighted peer group, to help you adjust to a sighted world if you're going to be in it. I remember a thing that happened to me. I went blind in May of my junior year, and I did not see a certain guy who had been my roommate in college till about September. And he came and saw me, and he said, pardon my saying so, God damn it, Putnam, you ought to be wearing dark glasses. Well, my family had never told me that. And I did not realize that my eyes were distracting for people to look at. And only a sighted peer would have had the guts to say that to me. My family would have been too chary of my feelings. And that was a very helpful thing. I've blessed him ever since. And I think that the sighted peers are the ones who tell you what to do, tell you where to get off. I mean, it can hurt.
Sure.
But I think it's worth it. And that you couldn't get in a blind school.
It's hard for parents. You know, I don't think I realized until recently how hard it must have been for my parents. And as grateful as I am to them, there were a lot of other things that my friends told me that my parents probably wouldn't have because they were too close to me to see it.
Hmm. Let's get back to the idea of things that you really trained for. Sandy, you mentioned getting training with a cane. Were you literally trained in how to use a cane to get around?
Well, as a blind person, the actual technique of swinging a white cane is not difficult.
What is a white cane?
Okay, the kind of cane that most blind people use who use canes comes up to about the middle of your breastbone. It's in some cases rigid, in some cases it folds. That's a matter of personal preference. And there's a technique of swinging it so that when you walk, it will detect objects in your path. Now, the actual technique of learning how to use that cane is simple, relatively simple. The difficult part is learning how to navigate. I am going north, therefore east is to my right, west must be to my left. If I'm getting off this bus that's going north, I must be getting off on the east side. Common sense sort of things that are... As a blind child, it was very difficult for me, for instance, to comprehend that an intersection had 4 corners. I thought it had 2 sides. I stepped down off a sidewalk, I walked across the street, and I stepped up on another sidewalk. I didn't know there was more than that until somebody showed me. Now, because now I have a dog, which was another kind of training, and I am glad I know how to use a cane, but I like having my dog.
I must add something. I think that a lot of grown-up people don't realize there's a northeast corner and a south.
No, they don't. You're absolutely right.
Said grown up. You mean sighted.
Well, sighted, I guess, yeah.
But it helps if you're blind. Sighted. You know, like you can say, you could tell me that certain stores at 30th and Market, for instance, which is a bad example because there's no store there, but if you don't tell me what side of the street, I won't know which of the 4 corners to be on, whereas you can see it. It helps pinpoint things.
Two of you, Sandy and Peter, both have guide dogs. Bruce, you choose not to have a guide dog. Mm-hmm. Bruce, I'm interested in why you don't have one. You know, if I assume that that is choice, that you'd rather not have a dog.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't want to look after anything or anybody, I guess. That's one reason. Sometimes you visit certain people's houses, and they may be allergic to animals, and you have to keep the dog outside. And I have known a couple of friends of mine who happen to have guide dogs, and we may be walking together, going somewhere, and I will notice that they will walk way, way ahead of me. I walk along at a pretty good clip if I happen to know the area, and I know that there probably won't be any little kids standing in the middle of the sidewalk or bikes or anything. But anyhow, they walk way, way ahead of me, and it must be that the dog chooses that pace, and they walk very briskly like that.
Yeah, now, you have to do that. That's a problem with the dog.
Suppose,
the dog's
pace. Now, suppose some kid does, in fact, run out in front of you. You could really bowl the kid over, you know, if the dog isn't really paying attention.
Could I respond to that right there? Because that's a misconception. Before I got a dog, because I'm not saying all blind people should get dogs, okay, but I'd like to see people make a decision on whether or not to get a dog based on fact. Because I had a lot of misconceptions. I always said I didn't want a dog. I thought they were dumb. I thought they were useless. A person should be able to control his dog's pace. No question that a dog likes to go fast, but you can make them slow down. You have to, for instance, if you're walking with a child or something.
In a crowd of people.
Mm-hmm. That dog's pace is controllable.
Yeah, but it is hard to work a dog right. with somebody else at the same time.
Especially a cane traveler.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Because you've got to concentrate on the dog, and so there's a problem there. But I think one of the things... not everybody should have a dog. One of the problems with having a dog is it's like marrying someone.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you've got good marriages and bad marriages, and maybe you'd rather be a bachelor.
That's right.
Personally, I have a very good marriage with this dog, and it's just marvelous. I'm never alone. She's wonderful. I mean, I had a marvelous thing happen the other day in New York. You'll appreciate this, Sandy. I was having lunch with a guy. Matter of fact, the director of Recording for the Blind. And for some reason, I can never explain this. I got up after lunch, and I hadn't been drinking, and I didn't pick up Hess's leash.
I did that one.
And started to walk away with him, with Stuart Brothers, my mm-hmm. friend. I'd gone about four places, and there was this thing against my leg. There was Hesse, exactly where she ought to be.
I did that one time, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a wonderful feeling about that. Not about mobility or anything else. You just feel reinforced by having the dog.
Yeah. What happened when you left your dog, Sandy?
I didn't get that far. She wouldn't let me. She jumped up and came running after me. You asked about dogs, and one of the points I'd like to bring up, I think, about why I prefer a dog... You know, a cane is a perfectly safe way to travel. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with using a white cane. And when I was a cane traveler, I used to kind of resent it when people would come up to me and say, why don't you have a dog? Well, you know, because I didn't want one, you know. But I find a dog is, I can listen to the birds more. I can walk down the street with a friend and I don't have to hang on to my friend's arm if I don't choose to. I can just sort of listen to the sounds around me a little more than I think you can as a cane traveler. That's just a matter of personal preference, and it's not a dog is not necessary. They're both perfectly safe ways of getting around, and I think the public should realize that.
I do a lot of my riding when I'm walking with my dog, and I don't think I would be able to concentrate on thoughts if I had a cane.
What are some of the reactions people have to your dogs, reactions that you'd that maybe are the wrong reactions to have? Do people come up and pet your dogs?
Yeah, you cannot tell them, and you can tell this over and over and over again, and they will never get it. When a dog has on a harness, it is on duty. And one of the stories I tell in my book is of Jack Humphrey, who was the first real trainer of dogs in this country, and he was taking a bus with a dog he was training in Morristown. And a woman leaned over and patted the dog, and he waited about 3 minutes. Then he leaned over and patted the woman. And she said, "What do you mean? You don't know me." And he said, "Yeah, and you don't know my dog."
That's
but
great.
It's really because the dog is supposed to be lying there quietly on the bus. That's why they're accepted in the bus or in the restaurant or any place. Now, you don't want to be mean about it. Obviously, the dogs want to be patted. People want to pat them, but they really shouldn't.
You should really
When you take the harness off, you can play like crazy.
I have no problems with people coming up and saying, "May I pet your dog?" And then I can say yes or no. But don't pet without asking. And do not ever, never feed a guide dog. Someone give my dog a chocolate donut on the subway one morning. And, of course, being a dog, she took it. These dogs are allowed in
restaurants.
They're
not thinking of the possibility that this will create diarrhea.
That's right. And chances are that it will, because these dogs are accustomed to a very steady diet. It's usually the same diet, because you want them to be regular in their habits, because they do spend so much time in public places. So never feed a dog, and certainly don't pet it without asking the owner. I think those are the two hallmarks for people to remember.
What are some of the assumptions you think people make of you when they see you walking into the subway or down the street and know that you're blind because you have a guide dog or because you're traveling with a cane?
It depends on the intelligence of the person. If they are intelligent people, they will maybe take the time to realize that I must know what I'm doing or I wouldn't be there. Somebody that might not reason things out would literally come running up to me, right, and grab onto me, which is a no-no, you know. That's a no-no.
Sandy,
they may be very intelligent in other respects, Bruce, it's just that.
If you think a blind person may need help, please ask. Don't grab. If you grab me, I'm going to push you away, because you may not mean to do it, but you could throw a blind person off balance by grabbing. It's not what you intend to do, but if you think about it, you're grabbing from behind. And certainly don't grab the dog's harness. That's even more awkward. If you think I need help, just ask me, and I'll either tell you yes, please, or no, thank you. And if a blind person tells you no, leave them alone. They said no. If they get into trouble, it's not your problem.
A blind person operating a dog, too, and it may be the same with a cane, is you're paying attention to the dog, and they're asking you questions and whatnot. You can't always answer them right away.
That's
you're
right.
A little bit in the position of a fielder who's catching a fly ball, you know, and you're concentrating on where the ball is, and you're not in shape to discuss conversation sometimes, you know, when it's a tricky situation.
You know, I've always assumed that when you're traveling with a guide dog, that basically you hold on to the leash and the dog walks. And, you know, you feel where the dog is. But it sounds like you really have to give a lot of your energy to what's happening with the dog and what signals you're trying to communicate to the dog.
You hold on
and it's giving to you.
Yeah. You hold on to the harness. You hold on to the leash in order to know the movements of the dog's head. The harness is more for guiding purposes. The dogs operate, they go left, right, or forward on your command. But a common misconception that the public has is the dog does not tell you when it's safe to cross the street. Dogs cannot see red and green lights. They're colorblind. You have to cross the street whether you use a dog or a cane by listening to traffic patterns and judging when to cross by the flow of traffic. That comes with practice. So if you come up to me and you say to me the light's green, I'm probably going to ignore you because I don't know you and I don't know your judgment about whether you cross streets in a sane fashion or not. So you're probably going to distract me. So the best thing really is to just ignore me. But what a dog will do, if I cross that street, and let's say a car turns right on red, groups of blind people have been fighting that because it's very dangerous. Because we don't step off the curb until the traffic starts. And so the driver who's going to turn right thinks we're not moving because sighted people start when the light turns. We wait till the traffic starts. My dog will back up like a flash if that car is coming around the corner at me. But the dog will not tell me when to cross the street. That is my decision. And if I do it wrong, this bothers me, and then I'll get off my soapbox. It bothers me a lot when I hear people say, "That's not a good dog." My dog probably didn't make the mistake. The chances are that I did. Because these dogs really don't make that many decisions in terms of whether we go now. They do in terms of objects and steps. But most of the mistakes you see are mine, not the dogs. Most people think these dogs really do more, I think, than they do. They attribute a lot of intelligence to the dog because they really don't think we can do too much.
More and less. I mean, it's remarkable, you know. They do marvelous things, and then other times we have to be on the ball.
Sometimes they're really dumb.
Bruce, do you cross the street similar to the way Sandy described, by listening to traffic patterns?
Have to. There's no other way. You know, you have to. That's right. Yeah, it's... I don't like that right on red business either. You know, it's something you have to sort of play eeny meeny miny moe or gamble with somehow or other. You know, I will turn my head to the left. Let's say if I'm on the right hand side of the street, and just sort of turn my head to the left and listen for it. If it sounds like there's a whole lot of traffic, I might let two or three of them go by and wait for a little bit of a space. And then I will walk out there, and every once in a while, a guy will start turning while I'm in the middle of the street, and I will hold my left hand up, and I will say something to the guy. Probably something inaudible, much like a guy driving a car will say to somebody that's getting ready to make a left-hand turn, and then all of a sudden he decides he wants to turn right, you know. So, whatever.
What's the how do you know who to trust?
How do you know whom to trust?
Whom to trust. Someone comes up to you and they say, can I help you cross the street? Do you need help? Say it's a weird traffic pattern. You would like the assistance. But I wouldn't trust just anyone in the street.
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. And there's no one answer. I have made mistakes.
Yeah.
Just the other night, I got off the subway at a stop I didn't know. And I was at 5th Street, and I asked a man who seemed very nice and offered to assist me if he would point me in the direction of 3rd Street, of 4th Street, so that I could go east on Market. Well, I think he made a genuine mistake. I don't think it was that he was untrustworthy. I think he made a mistake, and the next thing I knew, I was at 6th Street. And when I crossed and I realized there were no trolley tracks, I thought, something's wrong here. And I went back, and I was okay. Now, that's a minor example, because there are really people in this society who would mean to do one harm. But a lot of times, it's people who just make genuine mistakes.
And you have to be careful sometimes. You have to try and decide in the space of 4 or 5 or 6 seconds whether the person has been drinking and all that kind of stuff. You know, you have to try to make spot decisions.
Peter, what are some of the things that you would use to determine if someone's trustworthy or not?
Gee, I don't know. I just instinct,
that's
I
all
guess.
It is. That's all it is.
I don't know.
You just know it sometimes, and I've avoided people's help if I had a strong reaction against a person.
Mm-hmm.
I have at times bought things. Let's say I paid with something for a $10 bill, and it cost $2. And I have asked a person if I had a feeling I shouldn't trust the person to give me 8 ones. Mm-hmm. And if they won't, I won't buy the object. Not often. Once or twice I've done that, and I've just had this feeling. And I'll go buy it.
How do you know if you have 10 in your pocket?
You develop systems of folding money. However you want to, you know, your own means of folding it. And then when you have it identified by a trusted friend or a trusted bank teller or whomever, then you just have got to keep your money folded in whatever fashion you've come up with.
Have you ever heard of people who could tell the difference between bills?
No.
No.
There was a guy, when
I
lived up in Boston, there was a fellow on the corner who insisted, a storekeeper, that he knew people who could do this. And he kept at me so that I finally, if it was a new bill, I could tell the difference between a one and anything else, if they were both new. I don't know that I could do it now, only if they were new. But there was a difference between ones. They were a little flimsier than fives and tens.
But you see so few new bills.
It surprised me because I never believed. I thought it was all a myth, but it wasn't totally a myth, let's say.
I keep a filing cabinet as far as money is concerned.
Me too.
Everybody has their own system. It's your own organizational system, and it's.
I think I've only been chipped once in 38 years.
In a store?
A taxi cab.
Everyone's been gypped in a taxi cab.
That's right.
Well, I'd like to reintroduce all of you for those of our listeners who are just tuning in. I'm talking with three blind people. We're talking basically about some of the systems they've developed to get around during day-to-day affairs. We're talking about how they go about their professional lives. The idea for this panel was inspired by something which wasn't this quote, but this quote certainly fit perfectly into it when I learned what it was. It's something that was said by a man named Edward Allan, and the quote is, "What the public thinks the blind are, that they will become." Well, joining me is Bruce Mills, a jazz pianist who lives in New Jersey. Also with us is Sandy Smith, who's an equal opportunity specialist who works with the HEW branch in Philadelphia, and Peter Putnam, who's president of Recording for the Blind, and he's an author whose most recent book is called Lovin' the Lead. It's a history of the seeing-eye dog. Are most of your friends sighted or blind, Peter, you must have an interesting mix of both, since part of your professional life is with a group that's
really
involved.
I really have very
work.
Few blind friends, and the only time very few, hardly any. And it's when I go to the seeing eye to train with a dog that I meet him. Just for I was very against being of having friends with blind people. I had the feeling always that people were going to try to put me together with other blind people, and I shied away from that. Now, that was a prejudice on my part, but I had it.
Yeah, but we all have to go through that. Mm-hmm. I went to a stage where I would not associate with other blind people for that very same reason.
So did I.
And I think for me, going to get my dog really changed me around, because my dog is from a little plug here, CNI, a school called Guiding Eyes for the Blind in New York. And spending a month with 11 other blind people, well, you know, that was something I was not accustomed to doing. And now I'm to the point where I make my friends because I like them, because they like me. If they're blind or sighted, so be it.
Did you have fun at the school?
I had a good time. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I think I have a ball.
It was really nice for 1 month to be in a place where everything was on my terms. The soda machine was in Braille. The telephone booths were in Braille. The numbers on the rooms were raised. Now, I mean, wouldn't it be nice if life were like that, and it isn't? But it was a nice little reprieve.
Bruce, are most of your friends sighted or blind?
Sighted. I guess most of them. When I was a little bit younger, I had a few more blind friends than I do. The reason is I went to a summer camp where I developed some friendships that are still lasting. And then I went to the Overbrook School for a little while, and I still see some people from then occasionally. But now most of them are just... people, musicians, various people from various walks of life.
Do your friends ask you about your experiences being blind? Do they ask you what it's like? Do they ask you what your needs are?
Not so much friends as people I might happen to meet, let's say, in a club where I'm playing or something like that, you know. And... I, too, come against the thing about, they say, I think it's just amazing that you do this and that. And I understand why they think that, because they have probably never met a blind person before. So I'll say, oh, that's all right. That's just fine. Yes, you're doing just great. And it would amaze me if, let's say, a friend of mine, somebody that I've known for 2 or 3 years, would say something like that. Just a person that you meet on a first-time basis is...
Yeah, it's the strangers, I think. There's a guy who lives next door to me, and he heard that I was writing a book. He just moved up. The only time I ever met him, and I mentioned that I was writing a book, and he said, well, now, how is that going to be published? And it took a long time for me to figure out. He wanted to know whether it was going to be recorded or in Braille, since a book about the seeing eye could only be of interest to people who were blind, you see. Mm-hmm. And in other words, only actors can read Lauren Bacall, myself, and mm-hmm. only bankers can read about the Rothschilds. And it never occurred to him that sighted people might be interested in reading it.
I think most of my sighted friends, our friendships were formed for other reasons than my being blind. You know, they were formed because we were in school together or because we had a common interest. And then maybe later they'd either say, oh, by the way, I've been meaning to ask you about that. Or more often than that, they'd learn just by being with me. My friends who have spent a lot of time with me don't have to ask me what upsets me and makes me angry about being blind or what makes me happy when I have certain kinds of successes. They know from experiencing it. And they understand more than any stranger ever could.
Are people, though, who are friends of yours, who are newer friends, I guess, uptight about directly addressing the fact that you are blind and worrying that maybe it's a very sensitive issue and they shouldn't really discuss it with you?
Oh, sure, I think at first.
Once in a while, we just have to put them at their ease, don't we?
Well, you mentioned before, Terry, before we went on the air, about using the word seize. It was like see and watch TV. that has nothing to do with vision. That's just a matter of speaking. And, you know, it would sound a little absurd if I said, did you hear television? I think that draws much more attention to the fact that I cannot see than if one just said, did you see it? It's just a normal pattern of speech.
What Sandy's referring to is something that I asked her before, which was, you know, did she feel uncomfortable if someone said to her, well, I'll see you tomorrow, or did you see the latest news about, you know, what happened down the block? Using see in a context that doesn't necessarily mean vision, but means did you get it?
I think it's getting, I think we all dislike these euphemisms, and, you know, visually handicapped or visually impaired. Visually impaired sounds much worse somehow than blind. Of course, some people are only visually impaired or hard of seeing or something. But well, I mean, they are literally. I, happily, I am totally blind, so I didn't have any problem accepting it. You know, there wasn't any question of pretending that I could see a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes I may talk about other disabled people to somebody else, and I use that very word, disabled. I don't know why, but I don't like handicapped. I don't know why I don't like that, but disabled sounds better to me.
I don't know. Disabled always sounds like maimed. Well, we all have our own feelings, sure. Yeah.
You know what I'd like to ask you your feelings about? Everyone has experienced the blind beggar, the person who, in New York particularly, I think, is on the trains playing probably an accordion with a tin cup, perhaps either dark glasses or a sign on his back saying, I am blind, any change you can spare, please put in the cup, or hanging around outside of a train station. Outside of the fact that it's someone there asking for money and you may or may not want to give money, does that bother you at all?
Can I dispel a myth right away?
Yeah.
When you see somebody who says, give me money to get a guide dog, and if you give them money, you just got swindled. Nobody in this country has to pay to get a guide dog. You may pay, and some of the guide dog schools, in particular the two that Peter and I have our dogs from, have a $150 fee, but if you can't afford to pay it, that doesn't mean you're not going to get a dog.
It's only a promise to pay.
That's right. No. And you know, you don't have to pay it upon command. I paid it 2 years later because I was a student and they never asked me for it. In fact, if you're a beggar, they don't want you to have a dog.
They take dogs away, or the seeing eye did. There was one girl years ago who got a seeing eye dog, was out in Chicago, and she was actually attending a school for beggars.
Well, and where was this again?
A school for beggars in Chicago. As a matter of fact, she was to be a street singer, and they told her she should sing a little bit off key because that'll get more money.
Something?
As a matter of fact, I think begging is probably one of the most lucrative things
going
on.
I'm curious. Is that girl in this city?
Oh, no. This was years ago. This would be back in the 30s.
Because I know a girl in the city that does that.
Well, when
I got my dog, and I think the CNI is the same way, is it not, Peter? I had to sign a form saying that if I was ever caught either abusing my dog, you know, willfully abusing my dog, or begging, the dog would be taken away. And I think that's correct.
Yeah,
I
don't think it's been helpful because a couple of times, this is years ago in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, a couple of guys started to beg, and the CNI came to take their dogs away from them, and they straightened up and flew right.
Sure. Why is that? Why do they take it away if you beg?
Because they didn't spend $4,000 at Guiding Eyes training my dog. $4,000 of money donated by the public so that I could stand on the corner with a tin cup.
And go out and gold break.
There's no question that I'd probably get more money with that dog than I would with a cane because dogs have an emotional appeal to the public, and it's not what you get them for. And I see a blind beggar, and it's all I can do to keep from taking my dog's leash and wrapping it around their neck. And I know that's not a charitable response, but that's how I feel.
I've talked to a few of them, and a couple of them, they don't seem like they're very bright. So maybe they just...
really can't get jobs or something.
Wouldn't not be able to hold a job or something like that.
Probably make more money than the three of us combined.
I'd like to hear about how each of you deal with clothes and with the visual image you present. People tend to make pretty quick judgments, which for most people can be changed once they get to know a person better. But for sighted people, I think when someone enters a room, you're meeting them for the first time, you're going to form an opinion on them in part based on what they look like, their face and what they're wearing, their bodies. I think this is a pretty typical response to people. Now, the three of you being blind cannot see the clothes that you wear. If you choose the clothes, it would not be on the basis, your choice could not really be on the basis of color or on pattern, because you couldn't really see it. Someone could describe it to you. You could choose it on that way. But I'd like to know a couple of things. First of all, if your visual image is important to you since you can't see it, and how you go about deciding what kind of visual image you want to present to people who are sighted. Sandy, can we start with you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have only recently gotten up the confidence that I'll walk into a store and buy a pair of earrings or a pair of shoes myself. I still won't buy clothes myself. I've got to have a trusted friend or my trusted mother or somebody with me. Because it's very important to me that I wear clothes that look nice. It's of paramount importance because I know it's important to everyone else. And I live in a sighted world. Now, maybe that's a little more difficult for me, but it's the fact of life. And I don't understand color because I've never seen. And I do not believe that a person who's never seen can truly comprehend color. I can learn what goes with what. I know the grass is green because people tell me that, and because it's a common fact of life. But I really don't have a concept in my head of what green is. But I learn what colors go together by asking questions. And when I buy a skirt or a blouse or whatever, I go through the clothes that I currently possess and I ask people, what does this go with? What does this not go with? Now, it's very important to me that I wear clothes that match.
Sandy, you're reminding me. I suddenly recall I had a classmate in college, and his roommates used to insist on going to buy clothes with him because he was colorblind.
Sure.
And he would come out with the most hideous things. So they saved him from himself. So it isn't all being totally blind.
But you asked about what kind of image we want to present. I think that I probably, you know, I know that there are certain styles of clothes that I like and certain styles of clothes that I don't like. But probably, maybe if I could see, I wouldn't be wearing the same thing I have on today. I don't know. I think that there's no question that the visual image I present is a little bit of what my friends like. But that's okay, because if I didn't use their help, I'd probably look ridiculous.
You think you can assume that since you like your friends and since you feel a kinship to their sensibilities, that what they choose in clothes would be close to what you would choose if you had sight?
Well, partly that, and partly my friends are good enough friends that I have had friends say, I think you should buy this, and I've said, no, I don't like it. Don't ask me why, but I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I maintain that right to tell them that. And I had one hassle with one friend about it one time where she thought I should buy something, and I reminded her that the money was coming out of my pocket. And since then, I think we've had a better understanding about it.
Bruce, how do you go about this?
Well, when I go into a store, I will generally get the attention of one of the people that are... you know, waiting on customers or that kind of a thing. And I'll just ask him, can I look at some pants, you know? And I have found, generally speaking, that people that work in stores are helpful. Every once in a while, you'll get somebody that'll say, well, what do you mean by that? But generally speaking, they're all right.
You trust people?
You go back to the same places over and over again, Bruce?
Yeah, I have. And I'll just choose some material that I think is just great. You know, it's a nice feeling material. I say, what do you think of this? You think this is all right? Really? Yeah. What about a shirt? And I'll try to get him to match up pants with a shirt and all that kind of thing. Now, interestingly enough, I'm going to tell you a little story that happened to me this morning. This has to do with, you know, a little bit of help, you know, from some people. It just so happens that some people were over at my house today. They happen to be contractors, and a couple of them happen to be girls. And the girls were there to clean up the mess that the contractors had made from all the plaster and everything they were replacing. So anyway, I was about ready to leave my house to get on the bus to come here. And it was, I was about to change my shirt. It was terribly hot, you know, just like it is outside now. So I asked one of the girls, you know, that happened to be standing there, would you do me a favor? Come in here and pick out one of these shirts for me, would you? You know, and so if they're around, if there are people around... Why not? Why not ask somebody to do that?
I have been known on a couple of occasions when I really wanted to look nice, to call up a friend and say, did you say, you remember that blue blouse I bought with you? Did you say I went with that skirt?
Mm-hmm.
And they'd understand and they don't laugh at me. They'll tell me, or you think that necklace, you remember what that looks like. Do you think that would look nice? I'll ask plenty of times.
That's one of the dogs.
That's Hessa.
Peter, how do you go about your visual image?
Well, I have my ever-loving Frau to pick out my clothes, and by and large, she knows I'm conservative. I dress as much as possible as I can, though I did in 1941. But that's it.
I'm wondering how much you can tell about a person by their speech when you first meet them, given what I was saying before, that I think a lot of people make quick judgments based on the way someone looks and the way someone dresses. Do you find yourselves making quick judgments based on the tone of someone's voice and mm-hmm. their choice of words?
Sure. Yeah.
Tone and the way they speak, you know.
Except the contrary to common myth, we don't hear better than you. So therefore, we don't make extra sensory perceptions that you can't. We might listen
but
more.
But we listen more.
Yeah. We don't hear better, we just listen more.
Bruce, do you get that kind of stuff a lot? That, okay, you're a blind jazz pianist. Mm-hmm. It must, maybe it's easier because you're blind, so you hear better.
Mm-hmm.
Do people, whoops, we're just having, excuse me, the microphone just got tipped over a little bit.
Which one?
See, we have a new set of the microphones used to sit on the tables. It was yours, Bruce.
Oh, I see.
I think one of the dogs just yawned and tipped it over gently.
Oh, my.
A little bit.
Oh,
everything's
my.
Back in the water, all set.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, sure. They will say this. They will say this. They will also compare me to every blind person that has ever become famous.
Yeah.
And I make it a point a lot of times not to sound like Ray Charles as much as possible. But, on the other hand, I am trying to be successful, let's say, in places that are not 100% jazz places. So sometimes, if they want to hear the Ray Charles, I do the Ray Charles. Why not? You know, if it means that they're going to keep me at the place or it's going to be a little more successful. But I'd rather not... be stereotyped as I don't think nobody here really wants to be stereotyped into any kind of a role or any kind of a
Terry?
Yeah.
Thing. I know we're running out of time, and there's one point I'd like to make, if I may. I think a problem, a bane of a lot of blind people's existence, is if you're in a restaurant, you're with a friend, you sit down, the waitress comes over and says, "What does she want?"
Oh, man.
You can talk to
boring.
Me. In fact, I've gotten some, I'll tell people.
Man.
You can talk to me, ma'am. You can talk to me, sir. And my friends will tell them. Just ask her. You know, please don't do that. Talk to us. If you want to know about me, ask me about me. You know, don't ask somebody else on the street, where does she want to go? Or if I ask you, is this the number, what number of bus is this, please? Don't ask me where I want to go. Just tell me the number of the bus.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, where do you want to go? I've missed buses.
I can remember situations with saying, is this such and such a store, you know, because I want to know the relevance to a landmark to another place. And as a coffee shop, the next thing you know, they practically got me in there on a stool, ordered me a cup of coffee, and I really want to go next door to get my watch fixed. That kind of thing.
Good point.
If we ask a question, you know, really, if you really want to help, if I ask you the number of the bus, please just tell me, and I'll say thank you, and then you can go on your way.
It's 5:10. We do have a few more minutes to talk. Two of the people who are joining me this afternoon, Bruce and Sandy, both live alone, and I'm really interested in hearing about how you've managed to set up an apartment so that you can get around in it by yourselves. Sandy?
Well, that's the least of my worries. I mean, the apartment was much harder to get around in when it was empty, and all the sounds reverberated off the walls. Well, I remember the day I moved into my apartment. This is just a little story. My parents and other friends were helping me move in, and the walls were at weird angles, and I kept walking into them at first. And I had beer and soda there for the kind folks who helped me move in, and my father said, "Go get me another beer. I want to watch you walk into the wall." Now, only a person who loves me could have said that. But, you know, I know that my drapes match my sofa, which matches my carpet, because people helped me pick it out, and all those things that are very important to me. I think the main problem with living alone as a blind person, I mean, there was the realistic facet that every once in a while, everybody who lives alone gets scared. And maybe once in a while I get a little more scared. And maybe I feel even a little more vulnerable at times. Not often, just occasionally, if something has happened that's got the whole neighborhood a little more concerned. But the main thing is the mail. How to get your mail read. how to know when your woodwork maybe needs to be scrubbed down a little bit because you've gotten a few fingerprints on it, or you've gotten a few marks on it from your shoes. And that's where friends come in handy. I can do it. If you come in and my apartment's dirty, it's probably because I'm lazy and haven't felt like cleaning, and it's not because I'm blind. And I think that's the common assumption people make. You know, I've got the same factors going for me that you do. And maybe I just haven't felt like it, or maybe I haven't been home. So if people tell me, you know, and they give me that feedback, then I'll do something about it.
Bruce, how do you go shopping when it's time to, you know, pick up meat or soup or bread or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
How do you find what you need?
I try to pick a time when it will hopefully not be too busy in the store, let's say like 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that. And I will ask the help of one of the guys that works in there. He might be a young boy or something who's helping put the meat away or helping do something else. And I will just walk with him with the cart or the basket. And generally what I will do is I'll let him walk in front of the basket and I will walk behind, and that way I don't be stepping on his feet. But so we just go around picking out the various different things, and that's how I do that. Now, let me bring up another little quick point. An unasked question might be, how do you tell meat apart from one another? Well, it can be easy. For instance, a piece of ham, if it's a ham steak, is very flat, and fried chicken is quite lumpy, right? And a steak, a regular beef steak, might be a little bit thicker than a ham steak, and so forth and so on. You know, and just like what I was saying about the filing cabinet before, you try to keep things in as much order as you possibly can, you know, and try to remember where you put everything, right?
How do you do it when you unpack, when you bring the stuff home? I can see how to do the meat, but what about you get frozen things or cans?
Let me see. Chicken noodle soup versus mushroom soup. Chicken noodle soup rattles.
It's liquid, more liquid.
Oh, so you figured it out, right?
Now, as far as frozen packaged goods, that's a little bit tougher. But, for instance, let's say Brussels sprouts versus spinach. Brussels sprouts might rattle, too. You know, they might shake.
And they're lumpy.
I think
most people, though, when you shop, don't you get in a rut, though, and you buy, you tend to buy primarily the same things.
Yeah.
So I know what my box of crackers looks like as opposed to my box of cereal, because I like to buy those brands. And I don't mix up the mustard jar with the pickle jar because they look different. A lot of it's common sense and practice. And if I buy a new item, I might get caught short for a minute and say, what's that?
Right. Well, is there enough stuff in Braille to satisfy you? Is there enough of the books, magazines, newspapers that you want to read that you can read, Peter?
But Braille, because I don't read Braille that well, I wouldn't read it for pleasure. I did a lot taking notes when I was getting my doctorate in college. But there is a marvelous amount of stuff. For one thing, the Talking Book has a Library of Congress has a tremendous amount of stuff for educational reading, of course, Recording for the Blind. I got to get in a plug for that, because we have in our master tape library nearly 50,000 books now, and they are in at least 10 languages and in every discipline you can imagine. And that is for professionals and anybody for educational purposes, students. And then there's a wonderful thing that I would like to give a plug to, because I'm on the board of that, which is Choice Magazine Listening. Do you know about that, Bruce and Sandy?
Yeah.
Because it distributes every 2 months 10 hours of reading taken from about 65 different journals, the National Geographic, New Yorker, Saturday Review, New York Times, and all kinds of Esquire, and the American Scholar, and so forth. I've got a much broader spectrum of reading than I would have if I weren't blind, because I would just read the New Yorker and, and Time or something. And this is free and will be sent to anybody who wants it. It plays at 8 1/3 RPM, so you have to have a talking book machine to be able to play it. But Choice Magazine Listening, 14 Maple Street, New York 11050, Port Washington, 14 Maple Street, Port Washington, New York 11050. And if you write to that address, they will make you a subscriber for free to a really wonderful magazine service, I think.
Sandy, are you satisfied with what's available to read?
No. Often what's not available are the offbeat things. And I love to read, and I love talking books, and I love Braille. I wouldn't want to knock either program. I think they're tremendous, and I use them both. But in college, for instance, there were some really strange books I wanted to read. And chances are they'd never be put on tape or in Braille because somebody else made the selection. Now, that's just a fact of life, and I'm not saying it's a condemnation. It's the truth, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, you should have tried Recording for the Blind. We record on request.
I know, and Recordings for the Blind did a lot of books for me for college. Yeah, yeah. I could not have gotten through 4 years of college and 2 years of graduate school without that organization. Mm-hmm. It's really a tremendous crew of people. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, as great as talking books are, and Braille, and guide dogs, and white canes, and technology, none of it replaces your eyes. That's just how it is. I mean, I don't say that to engender self-pity. It's a fact of life. It's all great, and all used together, it can help tremendously. But none of it replaces it totally.
Let me ask you something. We only have a couple of minutes left in the program. I said in the beginning of the show that when sighted people see blind people, the first response they might have is pity. Isn't it terrible? Isn't it a shame? How do you respond to that response, Sandy?
Well, I'm not happy about being blind. I've heard some people say they're glad they're blind, and I don't believe them. I just don't. I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd rather have my sight. But I don't, so let's get beyond that and work with what I've got. You know, you work with what you've got. You know, the chances are there's something I can do better than you. Just because we're all different. So, you know, okay, you've said you're sorry that I'm blind. Now let's get that out of the way and let's go on to more important things. You know, that's usually what I say.
Bruce, how do you respond to that?
Oh, I don't like it. What can you say?
That I think is so irritating is that they tend to define you in terms of your blindness. Mm. My blindness is an important problem, but by God, it is not my character and my total personality. Mm. I am something more than that, and as we all.
I find
this would
generally
mean that Helen Keller was only 3/5 of a person, you know, which wasn't true.
I find, generally speaking, that people won't say to me that they're sorry that I'm blind. But what I'll find is, for instance, if I'm walking on the street, this just happened this morning, for example, or this afternoon. Hey, he's blind. Hey, he's blind. Or whatever. They won't say that to me. So they're walking their direction. I keep walking.
Remember
in line,
that.
So.
We can hear what you're saying when you're on the bus and you're saying, isn't it a shame? Or that dog, that poor dog. Our dogs love to be guide dogs. They're so happy to have those harnesses on because they're praised. We know what you're saying because we're not deaf. We can hear you. Just remember that thing.
We're going to have to wrap it up here because we are out of time. I really want to thank all of you for being here this afternoon. It's really been interesting, and it's been a pleasure to meet you. Joining me has been three people. I've been with Bruce Mills, who's been here on Fresh Air in the past, talking about his music. He's a jazz pianist who lives in New Jersey. With me also has been Sandy Smith, who's an equal opportunity specialist who works with the Philadelphia branch of HEW, and Peter Putnam, who's the president of Recording for the Blind, and he's an author whose most recent book is called Love in the Lead. It's a history of the seeing eye dog.
Everybody should buy.
All three of my guests are blind. We have been talking about what the experience of being blind is like for them and how they go about their work and their day-to-day lives. Thank you for sharing so much with us.
Okay, I'll be seeing you tomorrow or some other time today.
Okay. That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Technical director this afternoon has been Jay Goldman. The associate producer of the program is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.